I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday will meet with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman has more from Jerusalem.
This is the first visit by a foreign leader to the White House since Trump took office last month, and the stakes are high. The two men are expected to discuss not only Israel's war in the Gaza Strip, but also issues that could impact the wider Middle East. Israel and Hamas are in the midst of a six-week ceasefire. During that time, Hamas is releasing several dozen hostages in return for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. But it's not quite clear what happens at the end of these 6 weeks, and talks are expected to begin this week on the next phase of this ceasefire. Netanyahu has been signaling to his hardline allies at home that he wants to resume the war against Hamas at the end of these 6 weeks. Trump, on the other hand, has signaled that he would like to see this war wind down. Their talks on Tuesday are expected to focus heavily on this issue, but also their shared broader goal of a peace agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
AP correspondent Joe Fetterman. President Trump on Monday agreed to a 30-day pause on his tariff threats against Mexico and Canada as America's two largest trading partners took actions over Trump's concerns about border security and drug trafficking. Trump on Saturday had directed that tariffs on most imports from the two countries go into effect on Tuesday. The two nations threatened to retaliate, raising the prospect of a broader regional trade war. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on X that on a call with Trump, he pledged additional cooperation on border security. It follows similar moves by Mexico earlier Monday. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization said on Monday hundreds of millions of dollars could be cut from its budget following President Trump's plan to withdraw the U.S. from the United Nations agency. Reuters correspondent Diane To reports.
World Health Organization member states are looking at cutting part of its budget by $400 million, according to a document released on Monday. Opening its annual executive board meeting on Monday, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus defended its work and recent reforms. He also again called on the U.S. to reconsider its exit.
We believe in continuous improvement, and we would welcome suggestions from the United States and all member states for how we can serve you and the people of the world better.
The budget cut will be addressed at the February 3rd to 11th meeting in Geneva as member state representatives discuss the agency's funding and work for the 2026 to 27 period. The U.S. is the WHO's biggest government donor, contributing around 18% of its overall funding. The agency has already separately taken some cost-cutting steps after Trump's announcement. But the document adds some board representatives also wanted to send a message that the WHO would preserve its strategic direction despite the challenges.
Reuters correspondent Diane To. President Trump on Monday ordered the U.S. government to create for the first time a sovereign wealth fund within the next year and said it could be used to purchase the social media app TikTok. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Trump offered little in the way of detail, and it was unclear how such a wealth fund would work.
So other countries have sovereign wealth funds, and they're much smaller countries, and they're not the United States. We have tremendous potential in this country, tremendous.
Details on how exactly the fund would operate and be financed were not immediately available, but Trump previously said it could be funded by tariffs and other intelligent things. According to the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds, there are over 90 such funds across the world managing over $8 trillion in assets.
We're going to be doing something perhaps with TikTok.
TikTok, which has about 170 million American users, was briefly taken offline on January 18th, one day before a law requiring its Chinese owner ByteDance to either sell it or face a ban took effect.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkey in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. M23 rebels in the DRC announced a unilateral ceasefire effective today, February 4th.
The M23 launched an official communique signed by Lawrence Kanyuka, their spokesperson, saying that they will start from 4th February a ceasefire due to humanitarian reasons.
Meanwhile, the United Nations is concerned about escalating health risks in the Democratic Republic of Congo. President Trump takes center stage at the African Mining Conference in Cape Town, South Africa. Botswana and De Beers reach a diamond sales agreement after years of negotiations. Human rights groups welcome Uganda's Supreme Court ban of military trials for civilians.
I think it's a really important ruling, and I think that it really reflects the values of human rights, of the right to a free trial that many people have been advocating for a very long time.
And Trump pauses new tariffs on Mexican and Canadian exports amid threats of a trade war. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. M23 rebels who seized the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo city of Goma last week have announced a unilateral ceasefire effective today, February 4th. In a statement on Monday, M23 said the ceasefire was for humanitarian purposes. The group denied that it was planning to capture the town of Bukavu or other parts of DRC. Meanwhile, Kenyan President William Ruto has announced that the DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame have agreed to attend a joint East African Community and Southern African Development Community Summit this weekend. Reporter Al Katanti Sibiti Jaffa in Goma talks to me about these developments.
This Monday, 3rd February 2025, the M23 AFC launched an official communique signed by Lawrence Kanyuka, their spokesperson, saying that they will start from 4th February a ceasefire due to the humanitarian reason. In this same communique, the M23 called up to the SAMI DRC, the SADC mission in DR Congo, to leave the country because their mission is no more important.
What is the level of fighting now, especially around Goma?
There is no more fighting in Goma or around Goma. Fightings were reported in South Kivu, around 80 kilometers southwest of the city of Goma, where FARDC succeeded the two last day to stop the advance of M23 in Kalehe territory.
The last we heard is that M23 was supposed to be marching on to Bukavu. Is that still the same?
Fightings were close to Bukavu, around 60 kilometers, and as I said before, FARDC succeeded to stop the advance of M23, but we don't know for how long.
Have you heard from the DRC government whether it would accept the M23 ceasefire offer?
Commenting on the ceasefire of M23, the Congolese Minister of Interior Affairs, Mr. Jacquemain Chabani, said they used to the lies of M23 and they don't care about it. What they want is that Rwanda leave his troops in DRC.
That was reporter Jaffar Al-Katanti speaking with us from Goma, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Meanwhile, the United Nations is concerned about escalating health risks in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here is Stephane Dujarric, the spokesperson of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Humanitarian colleagues say they are concerned about escalating health risks with the rainy season intensifying. There are still bodies of people who died in the violence lying in the streets of Goma. Our colleagues tell us that morgues are at capacity and hospitals and health centers are overwhelmed with injured people. While efforts to chlorinate water are underway with the support of our humanitarian partners, the lack of drinking water is forcing people in Goma to rely on untreated water from Lake Kivu, as we told you last week. Also in Goma, economic and other activities are gradually resuming, but schools and banks remain closed. Two humanitarian organizations and government entities have had their vehicles hijacked over the weekend. aid organizations continue to assess the impact of the looting of their warehouses as these groups try to resume the delivery of aid in and around Goma. Between Friday and Saturday, OCHA and its humanitarian partners jointly assessed displacement sites in and around Goma. Initial findings reveal that many camps have been looted, they've been destroyed and abandoned. While some people may have returned to their communities or sought refuge elsewhere, many people still lack adequate shelter and access to basic services. For its part, the World Food Program is telling us that they're actively pre-positioning supplies and ready to resume their operations as soon as conditions allow. The agency is also strengthening preparedness efforts in neighboring countries, working with UNHCR, with IOM and others to develop contingency plans. Given the risk of increased displacement as we've seen it, WFP is ensuring readiness in Rwanda, in Uganda, Burundi, and Tanzania. And as a reminder, one out of every four people across the DRC faces acute hunger, including children and pregnant and nursing women. Armed violence, continued conflict, and soaring food prices are obviously key drivers in the DRC's food insecurity. On the peacekeeping side, our colleagues at MONUSCO, our peacekeeping mission in the Congo, but mostly in the eastern part of the country, are telling us about their ongoing concerns regarding the reported advance of the M23 towards South Kivu's capital, Bukavu. As a reminder, since June of last year, MONUSCO is no longer present in South Kivu as part of the agreed upon disengagement plan with the host country.
Stephane Dujarric, the spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, was speaking Monday at New York. Uganda's Supreme Court ruled on Friday last week that trying civilians in military courts is unconstitutional. Human rights groups welcomed the decision as a major step in protecting the right to a fair trial. The government has criticized the move, as Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Human Rights Watch is one of the groups welcoming the High Court's decision, which holds many criminal trials involving civilians in military courts. Human Rights Watch senior researcher Oriem Nyeko said the decision is encouraging.
I think it is a really important ruling and very positive. I think that it really reflects the values of human rights, of the right to a free trial that many people have been advocating for a very long time. Civilians should not be tried at military courts. That's something that is agreed at many levels, including in international law.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni criticized the ruling, saying the country is not governed by judges, but by the people. Museveni defended the military courts, saying its trials reinforce the civilian judicial system to defend the lives of people against armed criminals. According to rights groups, Ugandan military courts have tried hundreds of civilians, including opposition politicians and government critics. In 2016, former parliament member Michael Kabizunguruka was charged with security-related offenses and tried in a military court. In successfully petitioning the Supreme Court, he argued that it was against the law for him and other civilians to face a general court-martial, GCM.
By its establishment, it was irregular, it was incapable of dispensing justice. And so anybody who went there did not expect justice to be served. The GCM hitherto has been used as a tool of repression by the current government, where political opponents have been taken. It has been used as a political tool just to fight the opposition, nothing else.
The court's ruling has given hope to opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who was abducted in Kenya in November and days later appeared before a military court in Kampala. He faces a death penalty for treason. Despite the High Court ruling, his court-martial case is expected to continue. Army spokesperson Chris Magenzi said a military court can try any person accused of conspiring to kill the president or commit armed rebellion or terrorism against Uganda. Kabazinguruka said the Supreme Court ruling over the court's martial issue is final.
I've read a document that is attributed to the president, and I don't want to pay so much attention to it because under our laws, he has nothing else to do but except to fully implement the ruling or the judgment of the Supreme Court. He can run, he can do so many things, but he cannot change a ruling.
He also says civilian defendants in military courts are treated poorly.
Before you get to the court, you are tortured by these soldiers. You know, once you're in their custody, the kind of torture you go through is very, very tough on you, and it leaves an indelible mark on you.
Museveni argues that military courts are beneficial to the country's security and ordered the Attorney General to propose constitutional amendments to prevent judges from interfering with their work. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 4. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A senior commander of the Somalia wing of the Islamic State was captured on Monday, according to state media. This comes just 2 days after the Islamic State leadership was targeted with U.S. airstrikes, and security forces continue a weeks-long offensive against them. Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the action of the U.S. armed forces was a welcome move.
I think the action by the United States Defense Forces to remove ISIS individuals from that part of Northeast Africa and Somalia is a welcome news for the local people. But the Somali government and its people have to help themselves get rid of these characters rather than somebody else doing it for them. So it's a welcome, and the population welcomes that. But they are concerned that the government of this country is doing its part to organize the population so that they can liberate themselves from corrupt politicians and terrorists.
The Somali government doesn't only have the issue of ISIS, they have the issue of Al-Shabaab. Are the two in any way connected?
Well, you know, terrorists, regardless of what names they call themselves, are terrorists. So they are brothers in terror, to say the least. And so Shabaab works in about two-thirds parts of the southern part of the country, while sort of ISIS in the northeast part of the country, in the mountains. But their agenda is identical in the sense of sort of getting rid of any sort of a culturally offensive political system for the population of this country. So that's what they share. And so there has to be a collective front by the Somali people with the help of countries like the United States to liberate the country from this scourge.
So in your view, this was a good move, and maybe it may help the situation as far as terrorism is concerned?
I don't think it will remove all the terrorists, but it's a good step in the right direction. As long as sort of our forces, that's the United States forces, are helpful in not sort of in ensuring that ordinary people in these areas are not hurt. Yeah, but it's also welcome news. The Somali people across the board welcomed it. So do the regional government and the national government. But as I said, the liberation is a long way off, because the Somali people and the government of this country is not organized to be able to do the job themselves.
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The 31st African Mining Indaba, or conference, is underway in Cape Town, South Africa, with over 115 countries represented. At the forefront of many discussions are the plans of U.S. President Donald Trump and the effect that the U.S. tariffs and the freeze on foreign aid might have on Africa's mining industries. Vicky Stark was there and filed this report.
The theme of this year's African Mining Indaba is future-proofing African mining today. But some participants are concerned that tariffs imposed by President Trump, most notably the 10% tariff on Chinese goods announced Saturday, will make this mission much harder. Here's Dennis Denya, Senior Executive Vice President of Afrexim Bank, which is involved in funding trade expansion projects.
Because China sources a lot of its minerals from Africa, that goes into its manufacturing, which then gets exported. There is potential negative knock-on effect on African mining if the demand is not there as a result of the tariffs. But we are waiting to see what the impact will be. At the moment, we can speculate, but we don't really have the evidence.
Trump's decision to freeze U.S. foreign aid was also a topic of discussion. South Africa's Minister of Mineral and Petroleum Resources, Gwede Mantashe, told delegates in his opening address that Africa should withhold minerals if funding is withdrawn. But Denia had an opposing view.
I think every administration has the right to determine how the national resources are going to be deployed. So the Trump administration has the right to determine where to use their resources. And we cannot impose on the United States to continue to fund certain activities. So it's up to the American people to decide.
Veteran mining analyst Peter Major says unlike China, the U.S. has been cautious with its investments in Africa due to several factors, including political instability on the continent. A case in point is the current conflict in the mineral-rich eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where M23 rebels and the Congolese government are fighting for control. Major urged the U.S. to continue with the Lobito Corridor, a rail project for the transport of minerals from Congo and Zambia to the port of Lobito in Angola on the Atlantic coast. The project was supported by former President Joe Biden's administration.
I think it was the U.S. putting a toe in the water, and they mustn't stop now. They must put the foot in the water. They must get the leg in there. They must maximize the value and leverage of that project and show Africa how keen they are to come here and help under reasonable, logical, beneficially good terms for all players.
Africa is believed to hold 30% of the world's minerals, some of them traditional sources of wealth like diamonds and gold, others used in products like batteries and electric vehicles, regarded as critical for the transition to cleaner energy sources. Delegates at the Indaba, which runs until February 6, represent mining companies, investors and government. There is a delegation from the United States, but all media inquiries are being directed to Washington. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
The government of Botswana and South African diamond firm De Beers say they have reached a new 10-year sales agreement following talks that have dragged on since 2019. Analysts say the diamond industry is sure to welcome the deal, as Botswana, after Russia, is the world's second largest producer of diamonds. From Gaborone, Nkudise Dube reports.
Under terms of the new agreement, Botswana's government will be allowed to sell 30% of rough diamonds mined through a joint mining venture with De Beers. The share rises to 50% by the end of the deal in 2035. Botswana hopes that will reverse a decline in diamond revenue. The government once received $7 billion a year through De Beers, but that figure declined to $4.2 billion in 2023 amid falling diamond sales worldwide. Addressing journalists on Monday, De Beers CEO Al Cook applauded the new government for ensuring a smooth conclusion to the talks. Under the previous government, negotiations were often tense, with former President Mokgweetsi Masisi threatening to sever ties with De Beers. The talks made more progress once President Dumaboko took over in November. Elodie Daguzan, executive director at the World Diamond Council, WDC, told VOA the organization is happy to see the sides finally reach a deal.
The World Diamond Council is thrilled about this development, which underscores the importance of long-term, stable partnerships in the diamond sector. Botswana has been a leading example of how responsible diamond mining through successful collaboration with the private sector can drive sustainable economic growth.
Daguzan says the agreement will bolster an industry beset by challenges that include consumer worries over so-called blood diamonds and overall cautious consumer spending.
We believe it will provide much-needed confidence to members of our industry who are currently navigating a particularly challenging market and seeking signs of stability. At the WDC, we remain committed to supporting frameworks that ensure ethical sourcing, transparency, and the continued contribution of diamonds to the well-being of producing nations and communities.
Hans Meekert, a researcher on diamond mining, says it was imperative for Botswana and De Beers to reach an agreement considering the global supply chain disruptions caused by sanctions on Russian diamonds.
This agreement between the world's largest diamond mining company and the world's largest diamond producer after Russia will therefore be seen as a welcome development. It will likely cause a sigh of relief, not only for both parties, but for the industry at large. And hopefully, it will enable the sector to continue advancing a more positive narrative, one where diamonds contribute to development and well-being, and thus offer a clear alternative to sanctions terms from Russia.
Botswana's Minister of Minerals, Bogolo Genewendo, said the government and De Beers will officially sign the agreement before the end of February. At the end of the new agreement in 2035, there is an option for a 5-year renewal. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
President Cyril Ramaphosa on Monday rejected Donald Trump's assertion that South Africa was confiscating land and said he was ready to explain his government's land reform policy to his U.S. counterpart. President Donald Trump's weekend announcement of tariffs on Canada, China, and Mexico sent global markets in a downward spiral on Monday. They recovered some lost ground when Trump announced he would postpone a 25% tariff on Mexican goods for a month in exchange for concessions. He later announced a similar pause with Canada. Views Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Other countries charge us tariffs.
President Donald Trump's weekend tariff announcement is being felt in Ottawa, in Mexico City, in Beijing, and here in New York, Hong Kong, Seoul, and Taipei. Around the world, markets fell Monday after Trump dropped 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and 10% on China. In Washington, Trump spoke of his agreement Monday with Mexico to pause the tariffs for a month in exchange for concessions from Mexico City, meant to stop migration flows and the movement of illegal drugs across the southern border. Markets quickly made up some losses after his announcement. He also announced a similar pause with Canada later on Monday.
We have to stop people from pouring in, and we have to stop fentanyl, and that includes China. Fentanyl has killed this year at least 200,000 people. It's pouring in from China through Mexico and Canada, and they've got to stop it. And if they don't stop it, the tariffs are going to get worse, a lot worse.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum sounded a hopeful note on Monday.
I'm sure that in this month we'll be able to have results, good results for your people, good results for the people of Mexico. And this was the result of the agreement. It was a good conversation with respect.
Economic scholars say consumers will start to feel the pinch soon and pointed to historical parallels. Steve Kamen is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
This brings us back to the 1930s, you know, when, as you may recall, a trade war was one of the factors that deepened the Great Depression as economies all over the world erected barriers in order to keep imports out. In the longer term, keeping tariffs high would end up reducing the total amount of global trade, which would diminish competition and reduce the diffusion across the world of technological innovations. And that could end up, over a longer term, reducing the pace of U.S. and global economic growth.
China's ambassador to the United Nations, Fu Kong, on Monday said Beijing would turn to the World Trade Organization for recourse.
We do believe that this is in violation of the WTO rules. So that's why China is filing a complaint at the WTO. And we may be forced to take countermeasures. And let me also emphasize that there is no winner in a trade war.
Trump acknowledged that the move would raise prices, but said the higher tariffs would be worth the price to bolster U.S. interests. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Mbote in Washington saying thank you for listening.